You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. This episode of Pizza Quest is brought to you by Central Milling. Hand-selected grain, expertly milled for passionate bakers. Visit centralmilling.com to learn more. Well, welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and we've got another very interesting show. We're really focusing this season on Quest more than pizza, or pizza whenever we can, but definitely a lot about Quest. And so today we have another Quester, again, slightly different subject than pizza, but totally related. And the subject is bread. I want to introduce you to Megan Murphy Gill, or better properly said, the Reverend Megan Murphy Gill, who will tell us a little bit. Megan will tell us about herself as an Episcopal priest and as an author of this book, The Sacred Life of Bread. I like that because it could be The Secret Life of Bread, but it's The Sacred Life of Bread. So you got a nice pun going there. And Megan, thank you for joining us. This is an interesting time for bread. And I want to hear all about your personal journey to writing this book and how you got there. But before we talk about that, can you talk a little bit about why bread? What is it about bread that fascinates you and seems to be happening now across the board? You're the second author that we've talked to who has written a book about the about bread in terms of its spiritual, you know, aspects. What do you think that's happening?
Why do I think it's happening?
Yeah.
Oh, I think, you know, in the you and I talked a little bit while I was writing this book, and we talked about the idea of bread as metaphor, right? There's so many different things about it, that it's a metaphor for our lives and for our quests. But the thing that I think that is happening, or at least what I have come to understand, is that I think it's more than a metaphor. And I'm going to just use some kind of church language, if that's okay, or religious language, of the idea of sacrament. And for me, sacrament is incredibly important to my own spiritual quest. And a sacrament is different from a metaphor in which part of the thing that you are meaning to talk about or you're pointing to is actually in the thing. So bread is, you know, bread is sacred. And it's not just like a metaphor for sacred things, and the processes are not just how bread becomes bread, are not just not just metaphors. And my cat has the zoomies. I don't know if can hear.
That. We love
she's
that.
Zooming. She's a little distracting.
What's your cat's name?
Anyway, so her name is Lizzie.
Lizzie, come on, Lizzie, let her rip.
Yeah, I don't know that she'll come over here. She's too busy zooming. Anyhow, so the idea of bread and the processes by which it becomes bread, the fermentation, the growing of the wheat, the harvesting of the wheat, all of those things, the baking of it, all of those are actually part of the sacredness itself and not just a metaphor for what is sacred. And I think my sense is that because we are all in lockdown for a little while, and some of us, you know, for various, you know, we were all in lockdown for a while, and we had time to kind of reflect on things, and, you know, maybe people didn't get into it for spiritual reasons. But I think by participating in those, what I think are actually holy and special and sacred, whatever language you want to use, if you just say it's just special, by participating in these things, like people started to feel a little bit more connected to the idea of like the sacredness of life itself. And I mean, like just all of the special things about being alive. So,
yeah, I think that word participating is such a key word. It's certainly a key word in liturgical life and in, you know, any kind of spiritual quest, is that it only becomes real when you participate the quest, when it's not just something you read about. It's not just something that you think about, but it's something that you're engaged in. And the lockdown was interesting because it kind of opened the door to a golden age of bread making in culture that's always been here, but there was a flowering of the puns just pour out, right? A flowering of bread making during that time. And it's interesting that, you know, your book and a number of other bread books sort of all were born during that period as well. So let's talk about the book, because you know, this is a book of a lot of things. It's a book of meditations. It's a book of you know, your personal story. It's a book of bread as metaphor, but also I think, yeah, it's very important that you pointed out the difference between sort of the metaphorical aspect and the sacred aspect, because, you know, I talk a lot about the idea of things existing on four levels of meaning, one being the literal. The second on only the second layer down is the metaphorical or poetic level. The third is more philosophical. And then the fourth is really the sacred or mystical level of meaning. And all of these things are not separate from each other. They kind of are layered on top of each other, but you can't get to the sacred without going through the other layers. And I think that your book captures a lot of that in the various chapters. So before you even started writing the book, can you tell us a little bit about your own background and your journey to both the priesthood and writing a book about bread on these many levels?
Sure. Oh boy. I mean, how long do we have? Whenever
I'll stop
anyone
you
asks
if it gets
me,
too long, but just go for it. Yeah, this is very casual. We got to start somewhere, and I think we typically want to hear about your journey to this present moment.
Right. Well, I think I'll start by saying that the first time I started to bake bread was also when I actually was starting to study theology in a formal setting. I started graduate school. I was a Roman Catholic. I grew up as an Irish Catholic, kind of in a very standard Irish Catholic family. And by standard, I mean
that would be the Murphy, right? The Megan Murphy.
It's the Murphy, and also actually even more so my mom's side of the family, which were the Meehans. Meehans and Mahoney's, and I can just keep going. So even more so with them. But I grew up, just as a kind of a standard Irish Catholic. My parents were both from big Irish Catholic families, and so neither of them went to college. I don't know, just kind of like a working class Irish Catholic family where Catholicism was really just a part of who we were, which didn't
Where'd you
mean
grow
that
up?
We went to church every Sunday. So I'm a military brat. So I grew up, I grew up in a lot of different places. So on Air Force bases, but I spent a long time in the second longest to where I am. I've lived in Chicago now for 21 years. Oh my
but
gosh, 21
that's not
years.
Your original home.
No, it's not my original home, but I lived second longest place I lived was in New Hampshire. So the New England area. My mom is from New England. Her whole family's from New England. So I lived there for a big chunk of my childhood, and it still feels very much, it's not quite home, but it has those like signifiers of home for me.
Sure.
The landscapes and the people and the way people talk and like the attitude, it just feels, I feel very at home there. So because of that, we were Irish Catholic. And so I was kind of given this, faith. I was baptized, received my first communion, confirmed, all of that, like all on time, but we weren't like particularly religious. But meanwhile, I was always really interested in church. I loved the music. I really loved the music. I liked going, as a kid, I don't know, I just liked, I think, as a grown up, this is of course in my adult lens, looking back, I loved all like kind of the non-textual things about it. So the smoke or the bells, the singing, just all of that sort of stuff. The stained glass windows, there's all these like aesthetic things to it.
This goes back to what you're
really
saying earlier about participating, because people are participating whether they know it or not in different ways. It's not always the way we think of participation, that those things were working on you and kind of seeds being planted in you for what was to come later, it sounds like to me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's exactly what it was. I wasn't really like a super active participant in churchy things ever until I became a college, and I was my senior year of college. In college, I started to wonder. That's not to say that I wasn't always deeply interested in like the idea of religion or God or philosophy. Those are the things like that I was kind of always like writing about or thinking about. And then when I was, it's funny, is when I was a senior in college, I was finishing my degree was in journalism, but I did a minor in political science, and I was taking this really wonderful class with a really wonderful professor on Western political theory. And it's just so like nerdy when I think about it. But then I just had this then a realization that, that I had actually been, I got really interested in kind of justice and social justice and people and the idea of like, you know, politics being a way, like a way for good. And I realized that I had actually had this gift behind me, which is the Catholic social tradition, Catholic mm-hmm. social teaching. Right. And so I decided to maybe like delve into it a little bit more when I became a senior in college. And I actually got fairly active with the kind of student Catholic group at that point, yeah. doing social projects and stuff.
There's so many different
okay,
ways.
So fast forward, what happened is that I really wanted to continue to explore that. I started to wonder if that was like a calling that I was experiencing into social, like some kind of social justice work, specifically from this like lens of faith. I worked at did some Catholic campus ministry at a college mm-hmm. here for a little bit. And through that, I was offered an opportunity to study systematic theology. I think there was a priest who was like, I sense that you need to study more of this because you're interested in it. And you keep trying to find a way to do this. And I think it's probably something you should consider doing.
Is this in Chicago?
Yes, in Chicago. Yeah, I was at UIC, University of Illinois in Chicago.
Okay, because as you're talking about a priest being sort of, you know, noticing people and giving them some direction. My recollection, I'm a little older than you, so he was probably more of my generation, but Andrew Greeley, I think, was at the University of Chicago.
Oh.
And he reached a lot of people. He connected with a lot of people.
Yeah, this was University of Illinois. I know Andrew Greeley, but I didn't actually have any like particular like connection to him. Yes. And I'm trying to remember when he died, if I was in college, if I was in grad school, or if it was before. I think he died before I was even there. I'm not sure. Yeah, so anyhow.
that was my
so
era.
Yeah. I mean, I have read lots of Andrew Greeley, his fiction and anyhow. This is like a long story. So I went to study systematic theology at a Catholic seminary with a lot of men studying to be priests and a lot of lay people just studying to do like lay ministry. I realize that your audience may not all be religious, but lay ministry, meaning non-ordained, you know, people who are just doing. So people were studying to be priests, and then obviously anybody not studying to be a priest could also study at the seminary's Catholic Theological Union, which was a great, great experience. It was a wonderful place to study. I had an incredible program. I was in the academic program studying specifically systematic theology. And that's when I started to bake because I was in school full time and I had recently been married. And so, you know, we had some more kitchen things in our house, in our little apartment. And this was in 2006. So also when food blogs were starting to really become a trend, a thing, right. but they weren't quite what they became, but it was kind of the beginning of that food blogging era.
Yeah.
So there were a couple of food bloggers I followed and I was like, and I had grown up as a appreciator of food. My family is they're big eaters and love food. And I, even though my mom was a single parent, like she would take us out to eat and be like, oh, we have to try this. So adventurous and interested eaters. And so this like was really appealing to me. And it happened basically at the same time. So it has been impossible to separate the two ever since.
Right.
Long story short, I took a class that I think really changed everything for me while I was in grad school, because I was studying systematic theology. The trajectory I thought that I was on was an academic route. I had the intention of becoming an academic specifically so I could teach in a seminary. This was really post, 2002. So that's when the Boston Globe broke the clergy sex abuse scandal.
A big story,
in the
yeah.
Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Big story. And so this is only 4 or 5 years later. And so there's a lot of grappling that's still happening. And so, I mean, it's still happening even, you know, 20 years later, but a lot of like figuring out like, what's the deal? Who are we? What are we doing? And so I felt that maybe my calling was to work in a seminary and to teach priests or people, men studying to become priests. Mm-hmm. And I felt really compelled by theology around priesthood, spirituality around priesthood, and something just kind of opened up in me. That's why
that was a big hairy, audacious goal of yours right there to go up, you know, basically into the men's club, so to speak, and hope that there would be a receptive audience.
Well, I was the only woman in that class.
Yeah,
of course. But you know, CTU, you know, you could take any classes. I don't know. I just, something cracked open, and I had some really great mentors at the time who were encouraging me to apply to various PhD programs with basically some of the writing that I was interested in doing around a theology of priesthood, and specifically how it, this is very nerdy stuff, but how it like theologically ordained ministry relates to non-ordained ministry. Uh-huh. But the boring part of that is that I felt really burned out at the end of my master's program. Mm. And I was, another opportunity came about, which was to work at, there's an editor position open at a Catholic magazine, and I had studied journalism, and all through grad school I had been writing about food. I'd actually started a food blog, you know, that sort of thing.
You were in the right place
and,
at the right
yeah,
time.
And so right. And they offered me this position because I had this background, I had been writing, and I also had all this theological education now. I say all this, but like 3 years. And so I took that position, and I also just wasn't, I kept thinking that the academic life just seemed like not really the right fit for me. So the long story short is that I never, the long story, maybe medium length, is that I never intended to be a priest. I just didn't even think about it. I was never opposed to the idea of women's ordination. I absolutely, for the longest time, felt that women should be able to be ordained in the Roman Church. Eventually, a lot of boring stuff happened. I was actually writing about food more on a full-time basis. I eventually like left the magazine, kind of came back, was managing editor. And in that time, we started attending an Episcopal church. We had had our son, my husband and I had a baby. And we started attending an Episcopal church because I realized through a lot of kind of spiritual crises and whatnot, after taking some time away from church and that sort of thing, is that I realized that if I really wanted to have a flourishing faith life, that I needed to take a step away from the Catholic Church. There were certain things that were happening that were just, I found deeply frustrating, and they weren't about faith really. They were really about like institutional stuff.
Right. Right.
And we found our way in, and I know this is super hyper religious. I always mean to talk about non-religious stuff, and I always end up getting as deeply religious as possible. We found our way in an Episcopal church where my friend was a priest, and our intention was to just go once in a while.
And before you knew it, you were being pulled deeper into
it. Before I knew it, I was experiencing some things, and it was kind of clear that maybe for a long time I had been.
Well, it's interesting that, and hearing you describe that, you know, that our lives do take twists and turns, and the things that we study early in our life, maybe they come back later on and become part of the intertwining, you know, vines that bear fruit later on. Being a journalist led you to, you know, one aspect of it, having studied theology and another, and then all of a sudden you're in a whole different place. You're in a different church, similar in a sense. I mean, if there's any parallels, it's the Episcopal and Catholic churches have a lot more commonality than, say, the Catholic and the Protestant faiths because of the priesthood, and that's the mm-hmm. common bond. And yet deep, you know, not knowing that you're going to be a priest or called to the priesthood, suddenly the glass ceiling was removed from your former life, and now a new option unexpectedly pops up.
Super unexpected. And when people were encouraging me to enter a discernment process, I was really reluctant. I thought, I don't want to go back to school. I have this job. I have this family. This feels very, way too disruptive. But just the more and more I said yes, the more and more clear that the path kind of became.
Sometimes these things grow slowly within us, which kind of brings us back to the metaphor of bread. And so what I'd love to do is we're going to take a little break here, and we're going to come back in part two. And I want to talk, you know, much more about the new book, The Sacred Life of Bread, and the stories that you're telling in here, because it is full of stories. And by the way, you know, to be transparent, of course, I was invited by you, to my great pleasure, to write the foreword for the book, which, you know, it's my new thing. I feel like my future is going to be writing forewords for other people's books rather than writing my own books, because in a few short pages, you get to be really creative. And so I really enjoyed getting an advanced look at the book and being able to write a few pages, you know, to say how much I enjoyed it. And so we're going to talk about all of that and the structure of the book and everything else, because we're really now going to take all that prelude that you were just talking about and focus it into expressing some of the insights that you've gained as a result of your journey to date. And you're still young enough to say, I can say to date, because there's probably a lot more writing and other expressions, you know, in your future. So I want to hear about all that as well. So we'll take a break. We'll come back with the Reverend Megan Murphy Gill in part two. So join us as we come back in just a minute.
This episode of Pizza Quest is brought to you by Central Milling, hand-selected grain, expertly milled for passionate bakers. Central Milling is the farmer, the miller, and the baker working together to preserve American farmland for tomorrow while providing the highest quality flour and grains for the bakers of today. Dating back over 150 years, Central Milling is built on generations of knowledge, and they know that premium flour starts at the source. Employee-owned, Central Milling works directly with their farmers to sustainably grow grains that have exceptional flavor, nutrient content, color, and baking performance, which results in one of the largest selections of premium specialty flour and grains in the country. Hand-selected for the highest baking qualities, milled, cracked, or blended slowly to minimize heat generation, then bake-tested for performance. Learn more about Central Milling and their products at centralmilling.com.
We're back with the Reverend Megan Murphy Gill. Can I call you Megan for the rest of this interview? For the benefit of old times. We've known each other for actually a while. I think when you were doing your journalism era, did I once serve as a resource for you? Did you call me for some article you were working on? Because I feel like I knew you before, right before all of this unfolded, right?
Yes, I definitely called you. Actually, after I had met you, I was invited to come to a pizza making event out at the pizza school out in Lyle.
Yeah, in Lyle, outside of Chicago.
And that's where I met you. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I had ended up calling you as a source for a story I had been writing, actually about bread.
It's so interesting, all the different lives that we live and the different hats that we wear at different times.
I know.
Yeah. So, so of course we've got your new book, The Sacred Life of Bread, and, the subtitle, let me see, I think Uncovering the Mystery of an Ordinary Loaf. So we'll talk, you know, we'll get sort of to what that means, the mystery. But once again, when you talk about the sacred or sacramental aspect of anything, we're really talking about what the churches would call the mysteries of creation, mm-hmm. the mystery of God. And so, mm-hmm. I would have to say that that's really ultimately the goal of a book like this, is to try to give another avenue in for the readers to participate in those mysteries and to have attain an understanding of those mysteries. I noticed you structured this book in a unique way. There's 12 distinct chapters, most of them with mm-hmm. both a theme and also a bread attached to it. But just to give the viewers and listeners some reference points. So there's a chapter called Soil. There's one called Inactive Time, Prayer, Faith in Doubt, In Place. There's even a chapter called Sourdough, right? Ancient, A Common Loaf, Sandwiches, Practice, and then ending with Ordinary Loaf, which is takes us back to the title. So what was your idea? How did you envision this unfolding?
Well, originally, I had envisioned the idea for this book came after a visit to Plainsong Farm in Michigan. It's a farm started by another Episcopal priest who had been inspired by another Episcopal priest to start basically a bread, like a flour guild for communion bread. So I went to visit this farm, and I had already been baking bread, and then I just was really moved by the experience. I had actually heard this person speak, the founder of that farm. Her name is Nuria Love Parrish. And I heard her speak at an event in Chicago and introduced myself, and we connected, and ended up doing a little bit of work with her. So when I went to that farm, I just started thinking, wow, there's just so much more to bread here than just making it, that there's a whole story here. I used to describe it as from seed to table or soil to table, the idea of growing. I mean, the journey of bread really starts in the soil when you plant the grain. Of course, I'm talking specifically about bread made with, with wheat. Yeah. But when you plant the grain, all the way to the, like from growing it to harvesting it, to milling the grain, eventually, baking, and eventually to breaking and eating. I will say that my original version of the book had a lot more agriculture in it. And the editor I worked with, who was really fantastic, actually encouraged me to take out a lot of those chapters to rewrite more about bread, and to specifically like my experience about baking it and my experience about, tending a sourdough starter. I think that she was right, but originally I had much more of like an agricultural focus. And then it became much more of like a spiritual focus. So, and then the chapter that the includes recipes, which I will say I was super reluctant to do that, from the very, very beginning, cause I'm not a recipe developer. Yeah. I was right. Food blogging at some point, but there are recipe developers, and that's not what I am. I am not the kind of person who wants to make the same thing over and over again until I get the right recipe. But I chose to include recipes that I was encouraged to think about, recipes that felt near and dear to me, even like as a starting place for some of these chapters, for some of the themes. And that's how I ended up writing about New England hot dog rolls. That's the one in
that's,
place.
That's such an important chapter to me. I thought, what is it about hot dog rolls, that, especially New England hot dog rolls, that really, you have a thing about that, I would have to say.
I really do. And so I think it was a good change to make, because it was a way to really think about my emotional connections and spiritual connections, as opposed to kind of the systematic theologian approach to like soil and then growing and then harvesting. I wanted to do the systematic thing, but instead I had to think about what were like the actual spiritual connections I had. And so, and I ended up writing about New England hot dog rolls, which I feel very strongly about.
Well, I want to find
There's
out why.
There's no other hot dog roll.
Because, it's one thing, you can see that it's not that big of a leap to go from, say, sourdough bread or, some traditional kind of bread, but to hot dog rolls, which are about as simple and mundane as it can get when it comes to bread. It's not the most, in some regards, you wouldn't say the most esoteric of all breads, and yet it's a big reach. And so I think that's what excited me about the chapter is that you were making a big reach instead of the sort of the more convenient, in addition to the easy reach, like sourdough bread.
Right. I mean, and I will say also, the recipe I included in there is not a part. I mean, it's more like a brioche recipe, but you make them in the shape of hot dog rolls. So it's less mundane as a standard hot dog roll.
You kind of goosed it up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not the same bun.
They're awesome.
It's not the same bun that I would have had at the at the what is it called, the New York System Wiener place in Providence, Rhode Island.
Probably not.
but what is it? Can you tell a little story about, you know, what it is about your connection to New England hot dogs that, you know, kind of rang for you?
Yeah. You know, I think as somebody who grew up on moving a lot, you know, I mentioned earlier that I grew up on an Air Force base, is that I personally don't have like a real strong connection to a particular place as where I'm from, as where I'm home. It's whenever someone asks me where I'm from, I immediately feel a little like uncomfortable inside. I've lived in Chicago for 22 years. I lived in New England for 10 years. And then other places I lived like 2.5 to 3 years at a time at most. And I think that for me, because New England for as a long time as a kid really did felt like home, and even a long time as an adult when I would go back to visit, like just things about that particular place, the way it smells, you know, the way people talk, attitudes. There's a sense of place to, like, for me, like there's a real strong, like I know that place. There's all these details that make that place its place. And I feel very connected to it. And when I moved from, as a kid, we moved when I was about, like I moved, I guess around 10, across the entire country, to California. It was in a very different place with very different kinds of food. I mean, the bread, different. The hot dog rolls.
Yeah.
Really different.
Yeah.
And I just did not expect for hot dog rolls to be different. I thought hot dog rolls are hot dog rolls. This is how they are. The split, you know, the split top with the side that you can grill.
You think a hot dog roll is a hot dog roll. Yeah.
Right. Well, then I quickly learned that that was not the case.
Well, and this recipe is in the chapter that you call In Place. So it really is rooted, you know, in this meditation. Each of these chapters is almost like a meditation on a particular aspect of an insight that you had. And so connecting to place, I think, was the theme of that chapter.
Right, exactly. And then, the story is that my grandmother actually sent a big box, like a computer size box, of hot dog rolls and also relish to us in California. And it was really important. It was, it made us feel connected, you know, the idea of like a connection to a place. It wasn't just the place itself, but it ended up being, you know, the family, the people.
That's interesting. Cause I had a very similar experience when I lived in California. I lived in a community of people, from all over the country. And, one of them was from Wisconsin. And he arranged to have his father ship him out a case full of Wisconsin wieners, you know, these, and he called them wieners, he didn't call them hot dogs, but they were maybe the best hot dogs I've ever had in my life. So we arranged for him to do it again, you know, the next year, because everyone fell in love with these wieners. But it wasn't just that they were wieners, they were Wisconsin wieners, you know, for my friend who had to send out, it was a bridge for him to reconnect to his own history, his sense of place. I mean, you could see the light in his eye when he was enjoying one of these wieners, was that he wasn't just eating the hot dog. He was revisiting his youth and all sorts of other, you know, taste memories that he had.
Right. Like there's a context for that flavor and for that taste, for that experience, and the context being that place. Yeah. Like all the things about what happens, you know, in that place.
Yeah, when it's kind of unleashed, it's awakened by this taste memory or association that you have with it. And you used another word earlier when you talked about connected. You were talking about how it connected you to, you know, your childhood or something like that. And, you know, I think that this concept of connection is a very powerful idea. And it goes back to the earlier phrase that we use, participating. It's, you know, I'm always drawn to a definition I heard of the word religion. We've been talking about religion a lot today, but to broaden that out, something I had at my own aha moment when I read somewhere that the word religion actually derives from the Latin word religio, which doesn't mean God. Religio means to be connected to. And that ultimately the purpose of religion is to connect us to something greater than ourselves. And for me, it was kind of like, why haven't I heard that before? You know, why am I only getting it right now? But you have these moments that happen at the right time for you to hear them, and then they stick with you. And that's become a guiding sort of force for me as I to allow me to talk about religion in a whole different way than just simply sectarian or, you know, denominational.
Right. I actually run into this a lot. What is actually religion? And I think so often in our culture, religion gets portrayed and understood even by religious people, and maybe even most especially by religious, so, you know, religious people, as a set of doctrines by which you're like living, or like, here's a list of right, here's a list of wrong. And as long as you're following, and they're like, this is religion, is to do all of these things correctly, whether it's pray correctly, think correctly, act correctly. And so it gets portrayed in that sense. And it really is a loss for those. It's a loss to think of it in that way. When, like you said, it's about being connected. I often use the term with, a lot of my parishioners, of the idea of like transcendence. And I don't mean like my spirit coming out of my body and transcending above myself, but the idea that I'm always kind of moving beyond myself to be more connected with others, other people, with creation, with, you know, the world around me. The idea is I'm always looking for that deeper connection to others. And that is the way that, to simplify it, that's where I get my deepest connection to the divine and to God, is by that connection with people and others.
Yeah. Well, and which,
and bread.
and bread is again another one of those connecting points. Certainly sacramentally speaking, bread is a major connecting point, you know, between you and your congregation. You know, I think that it speaks to the fact that you ultimately maybe were drawn to your destiny, so to speak, because you are by nature a connector. You sense intuitively the whole importance of something connecting us to something deeper and greater. And really, that's what I think of as what a priest is a mediator between two worlds. You're a connecting point for the people that you are the pastor for, or that you are, you know, part of your congregation. Without trying to gussy it up too much, you know, you serve in a mediator role, and
yes,
explains everything, and explains really what this book's about. Because as we're talking about this, I'm realizing, and I have to now reread it again, because it really, what this book is really about on the deeper level, is it's about participation and connection, and all the stories that you tell are about your journey in finding your way to participate with something greater and to connect with it in a newer, meaningful way, both horizontally, say, and vertically.
Right. I'll just say a little bit about, you know, in my role as a priest, a lot of times priests talk about the one thing that we can do that other people can't do in my church, in my tradition, is that I can preside at an altar where I bless bread and wine. And, you know, we have a range of theologies around, a range of thinking around what happens in that moment. And so I think there's certainly like a theology of me as a mediator, but there's also like a theology that this actually comes out more out of the Reformation, but we actually are also a Reformed tradition. The Episcopal tradition is the priesthood of all believers, and all people can mediate, but there is something about an ordained minister who does this in a maybe more intense or deeper way, and does it in a ritual to remind people of that connection that they have, you know, that opportunity they have to kind of keep moving beyond themselves to connect more deeply with the world around them, and therefore, you know, with the divine. So
yeah.
That's a little tiny snippet of the theology of priesthood.
You just given your job description. That's your job description.
Right. What's so important to me is that I do that over bread.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I do that around bread. Mm-hmm. So, I love that. I love that it's through, and it's not just about me. I mean, that's where I invite others to also experience their deepest connection is actually around what we call the Eucharist, but is bread. And we call it the bread of life.
You know. Yeah. Well, before we run out of time, there's two chapters in the book that I want to touch on real quickly. One is chapter that's, it's a common loaf is the chapter. I think it's called a common loaf. And the common loaf that you referred to is basically, it sounds like this common loaf has been used as a communion bread in your church. That is a gluten-free.
Yeah, not in the church that I'm in now, but yeah. Go ahead. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, because it wouldn't be probably, to mix metaphors, it wouldn't be kosher, you know, in your church to use this bread. But the bread, it was a gluten-free vegan communion bread. And can you talk a little bit about you know, how you tied those two things, the common loaf and the gluten-free?
Sure. Having a common loaf is the most inconvenient thing possible. It is in some churches, including the one where I work now, is that we don't even actually give any consideration to anything beyond wheat-based wafers, because it's just so much easier to do that. When we were baptizing my son, we were Episcopalians, or well on our way to becoming Episcopalians at this point. The priest who was going to be celebrating the Eucharist at that baptism has celiac, and she couldn't even touch bread. It made her hands like break out. So she hadn't actually held like a loaf of bread for communion in a really long, wow, like years and years, when she had discovered her celiac thing. So she had been using the wafers, but they're pretty like low gluten, like tiny amount of touching, like with her thumb.
Yeah, but there are some people who are so sensitive that just even breathing the air with gluten in it can make them sick.
Right, exactly.
How ironic.
She was at the touching stage, but not like the breathing the air. So the friend of mine who was also a priest at that church had asked, because he knew I was a baker, he said, "Do you want to try to develop a gluten-free loaf?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, do you know how many people have tried to do this? The problem is that it breaks, there's crumbs, and if you have like spirituality that is obsessive about not having crumbs once you bless the bread, it can get really cumbersome and it's really annoying. And then you're like, you find out, okay, well, this person's allergic to gluten. Well, this person's allergic to dairy. Well, this person doesn't want honey in their bread because they're a vegan. And then the new one that I learned was, well, this person is allergic to nightshades. So you can potatoes, you can't have potato flour.
Potato starch. Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so it's like really,
it's trying to create a bread that's like the theory of everything, a bread that everybody can have. And you did?
And the thing is, well, yes, I borrowed the recipe and I did some updating of it from there's a magazine called The Christian Century, and some people studying for ministry had also developed a recipe, and they had pulled it from someone else, and I baked it a few times and figured out a way to make it work. The point being is that I think the story I tell in there is actually about a parishioner who is, I'm just going to tell you, on even today, this very day, I mean, at literally this day, I have to deal with some of the things around him, just because I feel like society has really just decided that he's too inconvenient to worry about anymore. And he's probably in his last couple months of life. I did not use his real name in the book. But society is, and part of that is even because his health insurance has decided that it's no longer worth it to them to cover certain things. And so even though it costs them too much money, and there's just like a range of ways that this aged person is no longer convenient for the world. And so I meant for this chapter to be really like a reflection on, not to be like, you should absolutely do that, why aren't you like accommodating all things at all the time, but to be a way for me to reflect on my own frustrations, because it's deeply inconvenient and frustrating for me as well. But I don't mean that we have to always accommodate all dietary restrictions and preferences at all times, but it felt meaningful to the idea of having a loaf of bread that wasn't just, well, here's the quote unquote real bread, and here's the one for like the gluten-free people, the rice crackers, you know?
Yeah.
But the idea of getting to share in this one thing that is actually enough for all of us and is the right thing for all of us felt, I'm not there. Will I ever be there? Will we ever be there on this side of, you know, life? Probably not.
But the actual practice. That's a great quest to try to create something that certainly gives you some direction.
that's right. Yeah. Wow. So that is what that loaf of bread. I cannot claim that it's perfect, but for anybody who's listening who wants to have gluten-free communion bread, and they have what's called entinctors, people who dip bread in wine. This one actually holds up and doesn't create all the soggy crumbs.
Interesting. Wow.
I think it's a success in that way.
Well, this is a growing, the people who, like you were saying, are the inconvenient, you know, minority of people in the world, as a growing minority. There's so many more people who are finding that they're the challenges of life itself, whether it's environmental illness or, you know, allergies or, you know, all sorts of things. So I think that's a great mission to take on when you're talking about the mission of serving people who are almost forgotten by, as the rest of the world moves on without them. Almost has us, almost, you could almost throw the.
Right. And it's really easy for us to keep our.
They're kind of the modern lepers.
Right. Right. I mean, the thing it's what's to me really fascinating with the increase of, you know, our access to media and the way we can more people can tell their stories, realizing that how narrow our lens has been for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And that actually we kind of like need to open up and see that what we have thought as norm has maybe not been as normal as like we thought for so long. And that there are a range of stories and just people to accommodate, you know, in a common loaf. Yeah.
Well, it was one other chapter at the end of the book called Ordinary Bread, right? The Ordinary Bread chapter is kind of your closing chapter. So we go from a common loaf to ordinary bread, but the ordinary bread that you chose, and most people think of ordinary bread as being like just, you know, like white bread, a baguette is ordinary bread or a sandwich bread.
Right.
But you chose as your ordinary bread for the, and the recipe you gave is for a pecan, I just had it here, pecan cinnamon bun, right?
The cinnamon snails. It's
cinnamon snails. Yeah.
It's a Danish recipe.
So it's finished. Did you say? Yeah. Cause the
it's Danish. We got
it from Beatrice Ojakangas, who's an author who I know personally, and she specializes in Nordic Canadian breads. And she's written 30 some books, you know, so
introduce me. Oh my gosh. I love her and I love her recipes and her writing.
I'll see if I can track her down. It's been a while since we've talked, but yeah, I've done workshops with her in the past. She's terrific. So you got it. So basically this is kind of like a cinnamon bun, Danish swirl kind of thing. So why did you choose that for your ordinary bread?
Well, because it's just, that is an extraordinary recipe. I remember the first time I made it, it's like one of those things where when you cook it and you make it to other people, like you see the tears well up in their eyes. There's something about it. My husband always talks about, there's certain meals that I have made for him or dishes that I've made where he's like, this is the platonic ideal of the thing. And I was like, well, probably not, but I'm so glad you're having that experience of it.
Somehow you made a connection with him and through that bread. That bread has become a link to something.
Right. And these pecan snails were one of those, that was one of those experiences. I think I just wanted something really extraordinary. And that is still ultimately a recipe based on bread. It's their buns. It's a bread recipe, even though it has all the things, right? They're yeasted and has all the elements that you need for bread, salt, water, yeast, and flour.
Yeah.
And some extras too, right? So it just felt like a nice, I don't know. I think maybe at the end of my book, I wanted to point to the extraordinary that is beyond. And
it's interesting. The extraordinary found in the ordinary.
Right.
Well, if you want the recipe, if you're listening and you want the recipe, you can find it in The Sacred Life of Bread, which is not out yet, right? Well, as we're speaking, it has not been released. It will be released when, in May?
It has not been released June 13th. It's available for pre-order on all of the major, you know, places people find books, Bookshop, IndieBound, Target, Amazon.
So that's good. So you can order it now, but you won't have books in hand until June. Now, I'm interviewing you right now. We're at the beginning of Lent. We're in March, but our interview won't go out for a few weeks, probably not until closer to Easter. So we're getting closer and closer to the release of the book. But and I wanted to mention, because I want to have you come back another time with another person that appeared, you know, on Pizza Quest, who wrote a book similar yet different from yours, named Kendall Vanderslice. And we talked with her about her book, which is By Bread Alone. She also kind of takes a theological, you know, journey into the meaning of bread for her, and has come up with totally different stories, totally different journey, unique journey, but both have led to sort of common epiphanies in each of your lives.
Yes.
And I think it's so, that's why I asked you at the beginning, you know, why bread? Why now? Because all of a sudden these two books are coming out almost like within weeks of each other. And both of you asked me to write forewords for you. And I couldn't say no to either of you because I liked your book so much. So I was thrilled to try to, and the challenge for me, of course, was to write something that was uniquely different for each book, you know, based on what your writings were. And so I was honored to be part of both of these. And I want to have you both come on together so that we can have a discussion about bread, get into the deeper levels and meanings of bread with two of you who have struggled and grappled with the struggles of life and also the, you know, making meaning of your lives using bread as one of your lenses, you know, into an understanding of our Creator. So, Megan, thank you so much for being with us today and for writing this book. And
thank
for sharing
you.
Your story. And if anybody is interested, again, The Sacred Life of Bread, for now, look for it on any of whether it's Amazon or wherever you buy your books.
All major booksellers. Yeah.
All major mm-hmm. booksellers. Even if you support a local bookstore, they can pre-order it for you. So if you have a local
independent,
which we always like to support the local independents, you know, go to them. Sacred Life of Bread by Megan Murphy Gill. We will look forward to hit the shelves very soon and have you, and we'll have you and Kendall on together, hopefully in the future.
Oh, it'd be so wonderful.
We'll put it out there, and we'll have a brainstorming around bread.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. This has been really exciting. So it's been wonderful to talk about this stuff.
Thank you.
And of course I asked you to write my foreword because like who else could write this foreword? Other than you.
we're kindred spirits in that regard. And that's what, you know, and I think there's more of us out there, and the people that are, yes. whether they're writers or whether they're, you know, restaurant owners or they're pizza makers, or whatever. I think the people that follow Pizza Quest, our story here, our journey here, you know, our share at some level, whether it's, even if it's not on a quote religious level or a spiritual level, it's the participatory level. These people are participating
right.
in life. And are committed to something, to connecting with a deeper meaning of life through whatever it is that they're passionate about. And so I consider it kind of our tribe, our larger tribe.
Wonderful. Meaning through bread. Absolutely.
Okay. There you go. All right. So, Megan, thank you again.
Thanks, Peter.
We'll see you soon. Hopefully, I'll get to see you in person one of these days. I don't know if you get a chance. The Asheville Bread Festival is coming up. I don't know if you can get away for that. A one-day celebration in Asheville on Saturday, April 22nd. If you feel like driving down, I'll be there. We'll be putting on a lot of workshops, and people come in from all over the country for that. And then there's many other gatherings that draw people, whether it's bread, pizza, or even, you know, planting festivals, which, you know,
nice.
I know that you participate in as well. Again, thank you. Thank all of you for being with us today on Pizza Quest, and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Pizza Quest. A number of the conversations you will hear this season were recorded over a two-day period during the 2023 International Pizza Expo held in Las Vegas, Nevada. These recordings would not have been possible without the help of many people and our generous underwriters, but I'd like to take a moment now to especially thank some of the unsung heroes. My Pizza Quest partners, Jeff Michael and Brad English, our HRN recording producer, Liam Werner, as well as HRN's Matt Patterson and Joanna Garnett-Reipold, and also Alexander Mortati of Orlando Foods, who organized and coordinated the schedules of many of our guests to get them to our recording table throughout the expo. Thank you to all of you. Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.